In her book, the writer and researcher Eleanor Cleghorn makes it clear, in the course of humanity, the science of alleviating and curing disease has been an incredible achievement. Medicine can heal us, she says. It can restore our health. It can save our lives. But there's also this troubled history to contend with when it comes to women and their bodies. Cleghorn says, throughout that history, medicine has had this focus on female biology as the defining factor of being a woman. And that focus has distorted the understanding of illnesses, and it's kept caregivers from truly caring for or even at times listening to unwell women. Unwell Women is the name of Cleghorn's book, and it begins with two stories that make her point. They both played out centuries ago on the Greek island of Kos.
This young girl becomes strangely ill. Her chest gets heavy and tight. She's feverish. She's shivering. She has pains all over her body that soon begin to grip and affect her heart. And soon she starts to experience terrifying and alarming hallucinations. And she feels that she would do anything to end this torment. Her father finds her and he calls for the physician. And he's very familiar with what he's seeing. You see, this girl is young and she's not yet married. And he's seen this illness many times in young women who are not yet of marriageable age, just as they're starting to menstruate, as they are going through puberty, that their blood almost boils. It becomes too plentiful. And of course, he knows that the way for a female body to stay healthy is to procreate regularly, to menstruate freely, the two things being connected in ancient Greece. So to save this poor girl from essentially drowning in her own plentiful blood, the physician urges her father to marry her off as soon as possible, because the marital act, intercourse, would hopefully open up her body and release some of this excess accumulating blood. It would flow out of her, and of course, a pregnancy would make her healthy.
And you tell another story from that island, an older married woman here.
So an older married woman in another part of the island, of course, is seized with quite similar symptoms. Convulsions and fevers. Her eyes roll back in her head. She grinds her teeth. Her mouth foams with saliva. Her skin's cold. And of course, she's also really gripped by pain, especially in her abdomen. Her husband again calls for the physician. And the physician again has seen this condition many times in older women, especially those who have stopped having babies, who have stopped having intercourse. He realizes that her womb or uterus must be empty and dry because it's not being filled by child, it's not being impregnated. And so what he thinks it's doing is creeping up her body towards her heart and liver in search of moisture. Effectively, the physician diagnoses the woman with a suffocation of the womb. He really hopes that eventually her womb will be moistened enough to return to its rightful place in her body. And he listens to her body to see if this is happening. Because, of course, if her womb lingers too long near her liver, it will suffocate her and she will very likely choke to death. And, of course, if she had still been having regular marital sex, if she was still of a fecund age, then she would have been spared such awful misery.
Eleanor, tell us what these stories say about the themes and ideas in your book.
The female body was defined by its difference from male bodies in the ancient Greek medical texts. Women were more inferior versions of the male ideal. The male ideal being more robust, with stronger humours, able to withstand illnesses of the body and mind, because it had that sort of ration and strength. Whereas the female body, destined towards hearth and home, destined towards a reproductive life and a domestic life, didn't have the physiological outlets, or wasn't perceived to have the same physiological outlets as the male body. And so was almost from the get-go, at this very early stage in medical thinking, conceived of as unwell, as defective, as pathological, marked out by its difference, not just physiologically with organs, but also from the nature of what that body was intended to do, or how that body was intended to behave in society. So I draw on these two stories at the beginning of Unwell Women, because they also really demonstrate something that remains very foundational for centuries to come, in that the healthiest state for a woman to occupy physically is one of pregnancy, is one of conception, and is one of domesticity. There is an ideal state, medically speaking, for women that's been really baked in to medical thinking since these foundational centuries. And this really is indexed back to the notion of reproduction being a social duty, and also to the notion of the female reproductive apparatus being not necessarily within the control of the woman it resides within.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Eleanor Cleghorn's book is full of stories like this, because really what she's doing is tracing this history of how medicine and the men, mostly men, who have practiced it, got women's bodies wrong for all kinds of reasons, like shame and secrecy and misogyny. So these myths took hold that, for example, a woman's womb wanders around her body, that menstruation makes her promiscuous or crazy, that legitimate conditions are just all in her head. Eleanor Cleghorn is a writer and researcher living in Sussex, England. Her book is Unwell Women: Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. And she told us the first thing you need to understand about this history is that medicine has never really been detached from human fear or suspicion or prejudice. Medicine has always reflected the social or cultural expectations of men.
Medicine, before it became the evidence-based science that we expect it and need it to be today, was always very enmeshed in the social and cultural world of what it meant to be human. And in the earlier centuries of medicine, of course, physicians who were interested in how the human body worked and wanted to care for it, wanted to cure it of its ailments and ills, they didn't have the diagnostic tests, the methods of analysis of blood work and respiration and enzymes that we can draw upon today. So they had to make assessments based on what they knew about bodies in the world. And medicine has never been separate, and I don't think it is today, from its social conditions. And of course, medical knowledge being a form of insight into what it means to be human, but it's also always been a system of power. Traditionally, the powerful people who have held medical authority, whether that's in the practice of medicine or the creation of medical knowledge, have traditionally been men. They've traditionally held authoritative positions in society. And that, of course, also is a reflection of a wider sort of cultural state of patriarchy, or how men are allowed to accrue and accumulate knowledge, where women haven't necessarily been afforded that right or have had to fight for it. But medicine is always reflected. So when we have huge transformations in the world, whether we move to a different era of thought or a different era of a dominant religion, medicine has always transformed and shifted and altered alongside it. It's always reflected the world around it, and it's never. So I think the history of medicine is very much a history of the world.
Here's how you put it in the book. You say medicine constructed this myth that a woman was her biology. What do you mean?
What I mean, I think, to come back to those foundational stories of those two women in ancient Greece, was that women from the very beginnings of medical history and culture have been defined by their biology, in the sense that a female biology, female organs, has a very particular social purpose, and that that social purpose always sits sort of above and beyond the individual woman's own needs, wants, desires, thoughts. You know, first of all, a woman needs to obey her body or the whims and needs of her basic female biology if she is to retain this state of health. And that we see from the very beginnings in ancient Greece. We see it enforced even more in many ways as we move through the centuries from, you know, and the medics and physicians begin to understand the body more. These foundational ideas remain there. They remain very ingrained in that a woman as an individual person is sort of inseparable from this female biology that always has this wider social significance and purpose.
Let me read a sentence you write in the book. You write this: I became an unwell woman more than a decade ago. And this is the personal part of the story I wanted to ask you about, because you say sharing these intimate realities created this understanding and this knowledge. So let's talk about that. Talk about how much of your interest in the subject, even the book itself, comes from your own frustrating personal experience.
So I was diagnosed with a disease called systemic lupus erythematosus in 2010. And I had just been through a really complicated pregnancy with my second son. He suffered a heart condition while I was pregnant with him, which made his heart beat very slowly. And one of the only explanations for this very rare condition called congenital heart block is that my own immune system was mounting an attack effectively against his growing heart. And my baby was born thanks to some incredible consultants, fetal cardiologists, some amazing people, was born healthy and well, and he's doing so well today. So thank goodness for modern medicine. But how, at the time, how this would impact my own health or what implications it might have for my own health in the future were never discussed. So I was prioritized because I was a pregnant person, because I was a new mother, rather than as an unwell woman in my own right. So a few weeks after my son was born, I started to get very unwell with a heart condition of my own that, again, at first was very mysterious. And it took a rheumatologist who was very interested in my particular condition to puzzle out the fact that the heart condition my baby suffered and the heart condition I suffered were due to the same underlying illness that I had. And he gave me my diagnosis. Now, trying to come to terms with this illness was, of course, difficult and confusing and very isolating at times. And although I was being very well cared for by the National Health Service here in the UK, there were so many questions around my disease that my health professionals could not answer. Mm-hmm. And many of those really circulated around issues to do with gender. Why, as a woman, I'm much more likely to get this disease, why it was particularly triggered by my pregnancy, why, you know, there were women in my family with autoimmunity, but yet the genetics of autoimmunity are unclear. So I was being cared for, my life was being saved, but there seemed to be so many blind spots and so much missing knowledge. And that's when I began to mine the history of medicine to try to find women who I felt a sort of kinship with. And that sounds odd to think about going back through the centuries to find a sort of community of unwell women, but it felt like that was what I was doing, because I wanted to try and understand why we'd got to the point in 2010 when I had an incurable, mysterious disease, when we'd moved on so far in so many other areas of medicine. And as I looked, I was a history researcher at the time, so I knew how to research. And as I researched, I looked at papers from the annals of medicine, I read textbooks, and I traced the history of my disease. And I met, as it were, young women who reminded me of myself, one from 1902, one from 1955, some from the 1800s. And it seemed as if, although medicine had moved on exponentially since then that some of the really fundamental issues around women's pain, around the misdiagnosis of women's symptoms, around the misunderstanding and lack of knowledge of diseases that disproportionately affect women was still with us. And that was the impulse for me to start the broader research project that became Unwell Women.
Let's talk more about some of these ideas, some of these early ideas about the female body. You mentioned Aristotle, for example. He saw the female body is basically the male body just inverted. Then there's the wandering womb we talked about earlier. And you say all of these ideas, in all of them, the uterus is this dominant force that's woven into them. Say a little bit more about this, how we come to this idea about the female body, or how they were thinking about or trying to make sense of it, I guess.
Of course. So Aristotle did believe that the female body was the inverse of the male's, with the genitalia, as he wrote in a poem, turned inside out. And immediately this creates a situation where women's bodies are, or the women's organs are inaccessible, out of bounds, curious, hidden. And it sets up a sort of othering or alienating, I think, of the female body from the very beginning, that there's a sort of inaccessibility that means that the female body always has to be puzzled out. It always has to be worked out, figured out by somebody who isn't the woman who owns that body.
Right.
Of course. And the uterus, as I said earlier, was the primary organ of women's health in those early centuries of medicine, because women were primarily seen as reproductive creatures. And this almost makes sense in a society like ancient Greece. But of course, these texts written by authors like the Hippocratics become canonical, and they become the basis of knowledge that's transmitted, translated, and reinscribed over the centuries. So the uterus, really, from the era where it was literally thought to wander around the body in search of moisture, in search of health, from this sort of approximation that was made by the ancient Greeks, the uterus retains that sort of primary significance as medicine moves throughout the centuries, up until we get to a behemoth of, you know, women and medical sexism like hysteria, which is, of course, rooted in some of these ideas around irrational, unruly uteruses. So the uterus retains this sort of primary role, if you like, in understanding how women's bodies work and how women's health is affected.
You know what I don't understand, though, is the female body, it comes to be seen not only as anatomically different, but faulty somehow, defective, deficient. But it also has the capacity, of course, to give birth. And so if a uterus basically defined the purpose of a woman for all of these years, how did the ancients not come to the conclusion that having a uterus and being able to carry a child was not deficient, but superior or special rather than deficient or inferior? I don't understand that.
I think this is one of many paradoxes that are revealed when we really get into the history of medical ideas about women's bodies, is that on the one hand, women have this precious procreative power that's defined by this organ called the uterus. But what we really see is that being pregnant, being in that sort of active, fecund part of life, that's the state of health that is desired. So when we think about the story of the older woman on the island of Kos, all of her health problems are assumed to be because she's, as we would say it today, of menopausal age. And similarly with the younger unmarried woman, her health problems are assumed to be because she is, in inverted commas, a virgin. So everything pivots around this. And of course, this was very precious and it held, you know, extreme power there. And I don't think it's a coincidence that by pathologizing the uterus to the degree that the ancient clinicians, early modern clinicians, Victorian clinicians did, that it really removes some of that incredible power that women could have if the discourse around their bodies was spun rather differently as a source of strength and power rather than of illness and pathology. I mean, the obsession with the uterus, we see it as this, you know, important, bountiful, crucial organ. But then in, you know, sometimes in similar texts or the same text, we see it described as a cauldron or a sewer brewing up miseries and ailments and disorders. So it's really paradoxical and very contradictory often, these ideas that on the one hand, the uterus defines health, on the other, it defines illness. And this is one of many paradoxes that we'll encounter that really is, you know, a source of a lot of the frustration, I think, when we're trying to kind of unpack the roots of some of the issues we still face today.
Eleanor Cleghorn, we're talking about her book, Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be a listener-supported public radio station. We'd like to thank our community of more than 10,000 sustainers who make a monthly contribution to the station, starting at just $5 a month. Because of your support, all the news, stories, and conversations that you hear are independent, calm, and commercial-free. If something you heard on KUER made a difference to you recently, become a new sustainer or increase your existing pledge at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Eleanor Cleghorn's new book, A History of How Medicine Has Failed Women, because medicine, she says, is a construct of the man-made world. The first practices of healing and caring for patients were based on this assumption that men's bodies were the standard, that the female body was not only anatomically different, but defective, basically. And medical knowledge then, even now to a degree, is shaped by this idea that having a uterus is a woman's defining characteristic. Her book is called Unwell Women.
How does the rise of Christian theology influence all of the thinking about women and their bodies? I mean, the Bible gives us the character of Eve, the first woman, who, of course, is literally incomplete and imperfect.
Yes. I think that the rise of Christian theology brought with it, as you say, certain myths and stories about womankind and especially about female bodies. And if we think about the kind of information that there existed to do with illness and disease at that time. So the text that survived the fall of Rome, the canonical medical texts that survived the fall of Rome, were translated in light of new theological beliefs. So if we look at the ancient Greek Hippocratics, or for example, Aristotle, who postulated beliefs about the incompleteness, inferiority, defectiveness of the way that female body works, that is easily sort of manipulated or shifted narrative-wise into the idea that there's something unruly, mysterious, corruptible, that potentially in the female body. And this is an instance, I believe, where new learning or new beliefs is layered upon old understanding to create a sort of new version of something that has always been assumed. Mm-hmm. And of course, the fall of Eve is cited as almost proof in terms of those belief systems that women were indeed, as you say, imperfect, and that women were more bodily, more physical, and more at the mercy of their physicality and their basic biology than men were. And from this, you get some very punitive and pernicious ideas about not just women's bodies not working very well, but what women's bodies might be capable of, because they don't have necessarily control over them in the way that men, who are these rational, strong, robust creatures, can have.
Tell us about the book Secrets of Women.
So Secrets of Women was a little book written in Latin in about the 13th or 14th century, and it was attributed to an anonymous follower of Albertus Magnus, also known as Saint Albert the Great. It was assumed for a long time to be written by him, but it was actually sort of written in the guise of him or in the style of him. And it was a very strange but very popular book that was written for celibate churchmen and monks to instruct them in the secrets and curiosities of women's bodies. So primarily it was, or ostensibly, it was a book to teach celibate men about conception, reproduction, how babies are made. But the author set himself up as a sort of instructor in these matters of female nature in the subject of the secrets of women. But what he actually did was create a book that really painted a vicious and vile picture of what women's bodies could do if they were, you know, corrupted or sort of influenced. And he really believed that women held the potential in their bodies for some truly great evils. And he spread the propaganda, as it essentially was, that menstruation was really the source of women's potential to do ill, do evil with their bodies, and that women could, you know, entice men to have sex with them while they were menstruating, which would cause men to get awful diseases, leprosy, cancers, all sorts of things, and that women would become very deceitful and vindictive at certain times of the month. And it seems ridiculous and we can laugh, but it was actually a very damaging text when we think that at that time, sources of information about female bodies were scarce. Mm. And if you have a book like this, and it was very popular across Europe, it remained very popular across Europe. If you have something that sort of becomes fairly canonical, these ideas become sort of irrefutable. You know, it's not a book that positioned itself as a sort of a tirade by one author, but in fact was intended as almost like a guidebook or a manual, you know, to help churchmen presumably deal with women in their parish and help with childbirth, etc. But it really painted this extraordinarily absurd picture of what women's bodies were capable of. And it all really came down to this idea that women had no rational control over what their bodies did, and that because the healthiest state for women was pregnancy, that women hungered for intercourse, conception, in a way that could make them perform, you know, hideous acts of violence and deceit.
We have to say something about this extraordinary story that I'd never heard of Anne Green, because this kind of gets us to this idea of men claiming authority over the female body. Say something about this story. It's amazing.
Of course. So Anne Green was a young woman in Oxfordshire, and she was a young working class woman who went to work in the house of a sort of minister, lord of the manor, former county high sheriff named Thomas Reed. And so this is in the 1640s that Anne goes to work for the Reed family. And she's effectively a scullery maid. She's one of many staff at this huge manor house. And while she is working there, she is raped by the grandson of the master of her house, who is 16. Anne at the time was 22. And when in 1650, Anne was thought to have become pregnant as a result of this terrible assault. And 4 months later, she actually went into labour and gave birth to a woefully premature stillborn baby. And she was very, very frightened, and she buried the baby. But unfortunately, what she had done was discovered by some of the other staff at the Reed's house, and she was sent to an Oxfordshire jail to await her trial. And she was tried for infanticide, for the crime of infanticide, which at that time in the 17th century could only be applied to, in inverted commas, lewd women. So this would mean unmarried women. That's when infanticide became a public offence. So Anne was hanged. And her body was permitted to be dissected by three leading anatomists from the University of Oxford. And at the time, Oxford was the center of anatomical learning in England. And so Anne was hanged and she was confirmed dead by the prison physician, taken to the house of one of the anatomists to await dissection of her body. In the morning, the anatomist arrived to begin the dissection, and Anne appeared to be very faintly still breathing. Now, of course, being men of medicine, they responded immediately to these possible signs of life, and over a series of hours used every trick they could to revive her. They rubbed her body to get her circulation going. They tickled her throat with feathers. They fed her with alcoholic hot cordial to try and revive her. And eventually she did come back to life. And she recovered for weeks in the same room that she would have been dissected in. And she was thankfully pardoned and was allowed to go and live in the country with her friends after she was fully recovered. And she took her coffin with her as a souvenir, which apparently nailed above her bed to remind her of what happened. So it's an extraordinary story because it really points towards not just the ways in which women were condemned, of women of a certain class were condemned for doing things with their bodies, like they were not given, you know, she was not given a voice, she was not allowed to defend herself. It was assumed that she was committed infanticide, and no other crime was considered, least of all the assault against her. But while she was being pardoned, it turned out that midwives and women from the Reeds house had all come forward to say that, yes, the baby was born, stillborn. Yes, Anne was very young and didn't understand what was happening to her body. Yes, it was very likely that Anne did not know that she was even giving birth and was very terrified. So all these sort of testimonies from women about bodies and body knowledge come out in Anne's pardoning. And of course, the physicians who revived her, their reputations were really secure because in the eyes of the public, and it was, you know, a huge public story, they had brought a woman back from the dead.
I wanted to ask about the times when, as you put it, women's bodies do genuinely baffle medicine, because this is part of the story that you tell, of course, the conditions that are missed or misdiagnosed, like, you know, chronic diseases, endometriosis, lupus, of course, which we'll come back to, chronic fatigue syndrome. And you write about how the treatment of these conditions becomes entangled with these misconceptions that women have this tendency to exaggerate or to feign, you know, fake their symptoms. Take us through that part, if you would.
Yeah, of course. So I think that one thing that we are still grappling with today is that when women have symptoms that are difficult to diagnose, pain, fatigue, joint issues, an abnormality in the blood, for example, if those symptoms don't have an immediate diagnostic cause or can't immediately be attributed to a cause, I think there is a tendency to fall back on some of these myths and stereotypes about women's bodies that have been with us for centuries. Namely, as you say, that women tend to feign and exaggerate their pain, which was a real feature of theories and discourse about unwell women from about the 17th century, when we see the introduction into medical thinking of a very famous diagnosis called hysteria. Mm. One of the defining factors of hysteria when it was first sort of mused upon and pondered in the 17th century was a woman talking too much about her body, paying too much attention to her ills and her pains. This was sort of written into what a hysterical woman was. Hysterical woman was one that spoke up, essentially, that spoke up about her body, spoke up about her pain, maybe was seen to catastrophize or, and as we move on, caught attention of men, of physicians, of relatives. And hysteria was difficult because it was always a physician's definition. There's not one illness called hysteria. It's taken many different forms over the centuries, and its very name is drawn from the word hystera, which is the ancient Greek word for uterus. Wow. So it's always had this really intimate connection with, again, this unruly, untamable center of a woman's biological life. And almost any symptom that could be conceived of was at some point crammed into the hysterical grab bag between the 17th century and the 19th, when it really came to prominence as the sort of punitive, punishing diagnosis that we sort of know it to be notoriously. And it really seemed as if physicians, in their ignorance about what might be really going on with an unwell woman, would fall back on the hysteric stereotype. Hysteria was a catch-all diagnosis, an umbrella diagnosis, where anything could be kind of scooped up and explained via hysteria. And today we have, you know, we've inherited this legacy today where when women speak up, they're assumed, when they speak up about pain, they are assumed to be speaking of an emotional origin for their illness rather than a physical one. And there have been many gender bias tests that have really proved this, conducted in the last few years, that have proved that women tend to be seen as less legitimate when they speak up and narrativize their pain.
Let's spend a few moments talking about how these ideas about the female body were expressed in this. In the book, there's this litany of these, in some ways silly, but in some ways horrifying treatments. There was this review of your book in The Guardian that said some of the cases could come straight from The Handmaid's Tale, which it seems is true, which maybe we should talk about. I don't have to spend a lot of time, but we have to talk about Isaac Baker Brown.
Yes.
Because when you're talking about hysteria and curing this hysteric nervous disorder of women, he came up with a fairly horrifying and novel one.
He did. Isaac Baker Brown. If there was a character that you could transpose and put straight in The Handmaid's Tale, it would be him. Isaac Baker Brown was an English obstetrician and gynecologist working in the early part of the 19th century. And he was quite renowned, partly for being rather a sort of obstreperous showman who wanted to draw attention to himself and court celebrity in a way that was quite unbecoming to the rest of London's fairly upstanding gynecological community. Baker Brown was also very fond of furthering his surgical reputation, and he was an obstetrician at St. Mary's Hospital in London, where he performed ovariotomy regularly, which is the amputation of the ovaries. Now, this operation was very controversial. It carried an extremely high mortality rate. And in some cases, it did save women from life-threatening tumours and cysts. But it was also justified in cases where women's behaviour, temperament, personality and life choices were not ideal in terms of Victorian social ideals. And Baker Brown was controversial, and he soon left the practice of hospital medicine and set up what was essentially a small hospital asylum, a private hospital asylum, where he pioneered, if we can use that word, a brutal procedure known as clitoridectomy. Mm-hmm. And Baker Brown believed that by amputating the glands of the clitoris in mostly in young women, that you could cure nervous, hysteric illnesses, and also other chronic conditions that today we would understand as epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, and endometriosis. And he, as well as being very fame hungry, he and a sort of showman, he was also a Puritan. And he believed that women's sort of sexual desire, women's sexual needs or curiosities were the source of many of their illnesses and the source of a lot of social illnesses as well. And he really sort of created this idea, this medical notion, that masturbation, whether it was evidenced or not in a young woman, was a dangerous, vicious, and very damaging habit. And that the only cure for this was to remove, you know, the source of the curiosity, or as he put it, the source of the irritation. Mm. And we're talking about a time in which sex work is very prolific in London. There is a lot of venereal disease. There is a general kind of narrative in the city around social cleanliness, around vice, around lewdness. So Isaac Baker Brown was able to kind of hook into these fears. And he wrote books about how damaging the practice of masturbation could be and how it could ruin girls and make them unmarriageable and lead effectively to the downfall of society. And he promoted this material to middle-class families. He promoted it even to clergymen so that they could, you know, accuse, as it were, women in their parish. And it's an isolated story. Thankfully, this was a practice that was not performed by a lot of gynecologists in London in the 19th century, but it wasn't not performed either. And sometimes it was used as a justification for the cure of underlying chronic diseases. So it's a harrowing moment in the history of women in medicine.
You write about how for most women of the common classes, as you put it, in the early Middle Ages, for example, medical care was taken care of by female healers and midwives at times. Now, explain how that experience would have been different from when she encountered a physician who was a man, because there are a lot of really, I have to say, interesting, fascinating, terrific characters, these women physicians or women medics throughout time who play a part in this story.
So in the Middle Ages, of course, so much everyday medical care, health care, obstetric care would have been provided by women in the community to other women, especially because there was so much shame and stigma associated with women revealing, not just revealing their bodies physically, but also talking about their bodies to a man. And of course, physicians were, at the time, they were making money, so you needed to be able to afford a physician to see one. But of course, women's medical care of other women has been so crucial throughout history, but women have not been afforded the position where their knowledge has been sanctioned, where their knowledge has become the basis of official medical ideas, where their knowledge has been transmitted down the centuries. That right has always been owned, well, it was owned until the late 19th century, by men. And so when we look at the history of medicine, we're really thinking, what I write about in the book is knowledge created by men, transmitted by men, that became the foundations of how we think about human bodies, female bodies today. But there's this, all these other stories about how women cared for other women that are crucially important. And as we see women trying to enter the medical profession, campaigning and protesting to enter the medical profession, especially in the 19th century, is often on this campaign that women need women doctors, because there's still this culture of shame around women's bodies and a culture of silence around what women are allowed to say to a man, even to a physician. And this is often the campaign in which women try to enter medicine, as they say, in order for women's lives to be saved, they have to be able to confess their most intimate, you know, feelings and sensations and what is going on with them to a woman, because, you know, social credence would say that that was not permitted. And I think you get this back in the earlier centuries too, in the Middle Ages and the early modern period, where there's a lot of emphasis on how it's forbidden, how even to a male physician, a woman's body is forbidden territory. And from that forbidding, that's where, again, these myths flourish, these assumptions flourish, because there's still this kind of disallowance, like that connection is not allowed. So as well as men claiming the knowledge, there's also what they're also ingraining in that knowledge is a culture of silence, is a culture of social sort of oppression, stigma and shame. And I think stigma and shame around not just our bodies, but around our bodily processes is still very much with us today. I think that's cast a very long shadow.
People who will read your book will find great stories about moments of feminist activism, as you say, which begins in the, really starts to pick up anyway in the 19th century. And you take us through that story. It's a really important part of all of this. And then, of course, the stories in the book that you tell about the women who pushed back on these misconceptions, doctors, medics. Christine de Pizan from the 15th century was one that I just keyed on. she seemed like a really fascinating character. And she writes this book called The Book of the City of Ladies. Could you say something about that?
No, of course. So Christine de Pizan was a French woman of letters. So she was the only woman in France who was making a living from writing. So already she's an extraordinary character. And The Book of the City of Ladies was, I think, thought to be written around 1405. And it's a book where she rescued women from, if you like, the wastes of patriarchal history and placed them in an imagined city where their efforts and endeavors could be celebrated on their own terms. And the Book of the City of Ladies is often cited as one of the earliest works of feminist literature. And it was a real reclaiming of what women had achieved through literature, through history making, through myths. It was a really extraordinary book. And Christine de Pizan was actually one of the only people who challenged some of that truly egregious misogynistic nonsense that appeared in the book I mentioned earlier called The Secrets of Women.
Yeah.
And she has a conversation with Lady Reason. So the spirit of reason visits her early in the Book of the City of Ladies, and talks to her about some, you know, awful ideas about women's bodies and minds that were very prevalent at the time. And she brings up The Secrets of Women, and she says, you know, she calls it a sort of vicious little book and talks about the rubbish that it spouts about women and their bodies. And Reason replies and says, look, you don't need any other evidence other than your own body to know that what's written in this book is lies and rubbish. So even back then, between the beginning of the 15th century, this really profound understanding by women who are, you know, in this field, who are taking on these ideas, that women understand their own bodies and that these ideas, these myths, these falsehoods are being imposed upon them by men who are occupying positions of very unchecked power. And I think what's so fascinating about Christine de Pizan is that this is still something that we're striving for today, that women are reliable narrators of their bodies, that women know their bodies well, but that I think the way that the medical system operates often puts a wedge between that knowledge and women. And, you know, there's still this sense that we have to reclaim our bodily knowledge and be trusted with it too. So I think it's really fantastic that Christine de Pizan was postulating this, you know, so many centuries ago, and it's still essentially a clarion call that we're still uttering today.
You say in the book the only way to move forward and really change this culture of myth and misdiagnosis is to learn from history. But you also, you know, write about how there's a pretty long legacy here that needs to be, you know, talked about and, you know, debunked and dismantled. Are you feeling optimistic about what you're seeing in medicine these days?
I do feel optimistic. I do have a lot of hope. I think that we are in the midst of a reckoning with the health system, with medicine, with medical culture, and that I think now that these issues are beginning to be discussed, be talked about in mainstream press, be the subjects of books and memoirs, I think we're beginning to enter an age when, firstly, we're shedding some of the stigma around what it means to be ill, what it means to have a female body that works in the way that female bodies are supposed to. We're shedding some of that stigma and entering, I hope, for this next generation, an era where we're not sort of shrouded in so much shame. That being said, I think it's, you know, it's crucially important that we're able, as women, as marginalized people, as all people who need good healthcare, to be able to speak up. I think that's crucial. But as well as that cultural shift, we also need systemic change that does face up to the mistakes of the past, which have prioritized male bodies, which have ignored certain conditions that disproportionately affect women, especially women of color. But I think that when I say, you know, we face up to our history, that there is so much to be learned from what we've missed out on by assuming women are emotional, by assuming that women's pain is not real. You know, we've missed out on an enormous amount of knowledge making also by assuming the male body, usually the white male body, 30 something, is the default human. And if we can move forward into a way where we accommodate difference, where we don't include women as a subgroup, but in fact acknowledge that they are of the population, then we can create a more equitable health culture for everyone.
Eleanor Cleghorn, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doug. It was a real pleasure.
Eleanor Cleghorn, her new book is Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program was produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Carrie Watson, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.